It's Friday, June 28th. We're in Boston, Massachusetts, in the Park Plaza Hotel. And this is David Paulson. I'm with the Society for American Baseball Research. And we're going to interview the scout, the top scout, Bill Clark. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon.
This meeting is about a year late, but it's...
Better late than never.
Better late than never. You're a busy man. I understand you're leaving town early tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow right after the awards dinner, I'm headed to Pittsburgh because National Weightlifting Championship's out there tomorrow and Sunday, and they do 7 lifts over those 2 days, and I'm going to miss tomorrow, so I got to do all 7 lifts on Sunday.
So you're a man with several hats.
Yeah, you got it.
Bill, is it okay? This is going to be, we're doing this for research purposes for the Society of American Baseball Research, and it may be put on the internet also. Would that be okay with you?
Well, I resent the internet, but you can use it. Go ahead.
Maybe. All right, fine. About how old are you?
I'll be 70 on August 18th, so I'm 69 today.
Working man. Still a working man. Okay. And where were you born?
Clinton, Missouri, about 70 miles southeast of Kansas City.
And you grew up in Clinton?
Grew up in Clinton and graduated from high school there.
Okay, what'd your dad do?
Dad was a radio repairman until the Second World War, when you couldn't get radio parts, and he became a custodian at the post office and retired from the U.S. Postal Service.
And how about your mom? Did she...
She was strictly a housewife.
Okay. Have any brothers or sisters?
None.
Okay, you're only one. You were really spoiled then, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, first, when did you get interested in baseball?
Well, I was a player, a Legion player, and there was no baseball in my town of about 6,000 during the Second World War. Nobody played. And I can remember in 1946, they had a game between the Go Devils and the Rejects. They were a bunch of guys who...
4Fs?
4F guys. And they played in the spring of 46, basically before anybody had come back out of the service, pretty much. And I went to that ball game, and I was intrigued by what was going on. And the next year, in 47, I started playing American Legion baseball when I was 14.
And what position did you play?
I was an outfield.
You were right-handed?
Right.
Okay. And how did the team do?
Our team did all right. I guess I played all right. I played 3 years there until I ran out of eligibility and I couldn't hit a fastball, but I hit a curveball once in a while, so I continued to play.
Okay. And after high school, what did you do?
Basically, I went to the Army, basically. I went to the Army when I was 18.
Was the war still on then?
The war was just getting underway. This was the Korean War.
Korean War. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it started in 50, and I went in the Army in 51. Uh-huh. And I did 3 years in the Army, a year of them in Korea.
In combat?
It may have been worse in combat in some ways. I drove a gasoline truck hauling high-octane fuel up to an airstrip, which was... it was not in a combat zone, but they continued to throw things at that airstrip.
Right. Okay, and after the war, you came back to Missouri?
Came back to Missouri and went to the University of Missouri, earned a degree in journalism. Baseball-wise, before I'd gone in the Army, I'd gone to baseball to umpire school in 1950, George Barr's umpire school.
About 20 then?
I was 17. Just turned 17. And that made me probably as young as anybody ever graduated from a pro umpire school. It was really unusual in those days because almost everybody there was 35, 40 years old. So the youngest umpire in the big league was 38.
So was there a problem with your young age in taking
you
in?
No.
They wanted your money, huh?
They wanted my money and they said, you come down here, that's fine. They kind of took care of me because I was young. And I'll never forget George Barr, who'd been in the major league for close to 20 years. I made a call and somebody's all over me, and he said, hey, you're big enough to eat a brick without any salt. Don't back down from anybody. Kind of lived by that through the years.
Right. And how long was the course?
Six weeks.
6 weeks.
And it was an interesting thing. We were in that course. There was people there from that had been on the Bataan Death March. They were career military men. That was quite an experience to spend every day with them. And they were great hearts players. And they were telling about how they had played hearts with cigarette papers and what have you. And I got to meet Bill Clem for a day.
No kidding.
So that I got to span umpiring from 1900 all the way.
Were you familiar with Clem's background?
Oh yeah, sure.
Did he have any stories to tell?
Clem? Yeah, I'm sure he did. I don't remember them now, but I'm sure he had plenty of them.
Okay, so when you got out of umpire school, did you have a job waiting for you as an umpire, or you?
No, I was too young, and I had to go through the military. That's what put me in the military. I couldn't get a job. I was interviewed by two or three of the Georgia Florida League, and I think the Alabama State League or somebody, and they said, well, we're not worried about your age. We're worried about losing you to the military. So I took care of that. I just joined the military for 3 years.
Okay. All right, so after the military, then what? Went back to...
Went back to journalism school and went to University of Missouri. When
you went to journalism school, did you have something in mind of being a sports writer, perhaps?
Yeah, I wanted to be a sports writer. And I also still wanted to be a major league umpire. 1956, I went to the Central Mexican League, and I worked down there about a month.
What are some of the teams now?
Central Mexican, we had Chihuahua, Juarez, Aguas Calientes, Fresnillo, Saltillo, and Durango, I believe it was. There were 16.
Were you speaking Spanish then?
I'd had Spanish in at the university. And, of course, Spanish in the university and Spanish on the street in Mexico is a lot different. So the first thing they handed me when I got there was a list of about 15 phrases. And they said, if you hear any one of these phrases, the guy's gone. I carried that list with me, and I often wondered if, during a ball game, if I heard something, if I pulled that list out and went through them. You learn street Spanish pretty quick that way.
And any unusual incidents there?
Yeah, I've still got a newspaper. We had a game in Chihuahua one night, and it was a tough game. And there was a lot of controversy, and I don't remember exactly the details of the game, but everyone got excited, and when the game was over, we got out of the ballpark, got back to the hotel, and the next day the newspaper came out, and you wondered, what in the world are they going to say? And it called us Los Umpayos Impecables. In other words, the impeccable umpires. And that may be the only time anyone ever called me an impeccable umpire. So I really appreciated that.
The caliber of ball in that league, how did that compare? What would that compare with?
It was a C league. In fact, I opened the season in Juarez there. And Phil Pitton came down. He was the president of the National Association at that time. And that was the first minor league game played under the auspices of the National Association.
So it was connected with the...
Yeah, it was a part of... That was the first year that they'd ever had that relationship.
And they were all Mexican teams.
Yeah, they were all Mexican teams, and almost all of the players were Mexican. The only guy I remember playing in that league was a guy, what was his name? He's in the Mexican League Hall of Fame. He was an American, it was strictly Mexican baseball, and I was the only gringo umpire there. I worked with a guy named Emilio Sardá, who had played in the Negro Leagues here in this country, and was a Cuban. And he was back there trying to make a few bucks. He told me about, there's another Cuban here in Mexico. And he says, this guy's getting ready to return. And it was Castro. A couple years later, he returned with a bang.
Sure did. So this was in 1956?
56.
Okay. And did you stay there next year? Was it the same?
No, I didn't finish the season there.
Was there a reason?
Yeah. I guess I wasn't tough enough. It wasn't baseball, it was just a lifestyle and so forth. And so I quit after a month or so and came home. And I'd just been married, I suppose homesickness had a lot to do with it. My wife and I got married in 55, and less than 6 months later, I'm back on the road.
You're out of the country.
Umpiring, yeah, and she wasn't happy and I wasn't happy. So I went home and went back to the university and picked up some summer course hours. And about the 1st of July, I get a call, and it was from the Nebraska State League. And they said, we're interested in hiring you out here. So I went to the Nebraska State League, first year of that league. And I finished the season out there. And it really looked like I had a chance pro ball at that point. I had a good year out there and they liked me, and the guy who was the league president was also the president of the Western Association. And it looked like Western League, not the association, but the Class A Western League at that time. It looked like I was going to get a chance maybe to go to the Western League. But as things happened, my wife got pregnant and she said, hey, stay home, take care of your family. Finish the university, get your degree. So I did. And spent the next 3 years there doing just that.
Okay, did you do any writing for any papers?
In journalism school I became a columnist, sports columnist there.
For the paper?
Yeah. The University of Missouri has a unique situation. They have a radio station. They have a television station, the NBC affiliate there. And they have a newspaper that compete in the commercial market. So when you work at the University of Missouri's media, with the University of Missouri's media, you're head-to-head with the other local media market.
Great experience.
It's great experience. So I did that. I wrote and did a column, wrote a bowling column, did a lot of things on the newspaper. And when I graduated, I went to the Lexington Leader, Lexington, Kentucky Leader. And my first assignment down there was to help cover the what they call the Kentucky squirrel shooters. They won the NCAA in 1958 and basketball.
The Wildcats, yeah. Alice Groza and Lou Beard.
No, that was after that. They won in 51 or somewhere in there. This was guys you never heard of. Johnny Cox and Adrian Smith was the only guy who ever played in the pros.
Adrian Smith played for Cincinnati, the Royals.
Played for Cincinnati Royals, right. The only one who stuck in the pros. These were guys nobody ever heard of. And they beat Elgin Baylor in Seattle in the finals. Well, I got to be a part of that. That was interesting.
Did you move the family down to Lexington?
Yeah. Right. And then I got a job in the newspaper business back in Columbia. I was only down there about 6 months, and we moved back, and I've lived in Columbia ever since. Worked in the newspaper business there, and then 1962, I got a wild idea. I wanted to go back to pro ball. Once you're bitten by the pro bug, it's tough. And I should never have done it. I was years of recovering financially. We had three kids by then, and I went. I took a job. I went back to umpire school, and I took a job in the Pioneer League.
And what classification?
It was a B class.
You're moving up then.
That was a B class, and I didn't last a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it was. I had $96 in my pocket, and that was it. I had to live on that $96.
Wasn't enough.
I could live on it, but the problem was, my wife had no money. We owed $125 rent. And I had my mother-in-law's credit card, which I'd had to use to report on, because in those days there was no reporting money for umpires and no way to get home. You were on your own. So expenses were yours. So I used it. I quit and I used her credit card, and I got back home. The bank actually owned the house where we lived then, and I took $75 down to the bank and said, I don't have 125, but here's 75. I'll get the rest of it to you. And we had $20 to eat on. And I went looking for a job.
Mm. What year was this around?
62.
Okay. So what kind of job did you find?
Well, I hooked up with three jobs, actually. I would work from 11 at night to 7 in the morning in an all-night hash house, slinging hash, beating drunks on the head and what have you.
Back in Columbia.
And then at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd go home, take a shower, and go to work at the city as the recreation director, which was a half-time pay but a full-time job. And I would also, on occasion, still do some piece work for the newspaper. And so I was holding three jobs, and there would be many, many nights when I'd never go to sleep and just keep on keeping. And got pretty cranky on that 11 to 7 shift with the drunks that came in. Some of them got hammered pretty quick. Size helps, you know.
Right.
And I did that for a couple of years till we got the family back financially set. And then I quit the all-night job in the restaurant and worked at the recreation department. And then expanded my, I went, basically went on staff at the newspaper as well.
Doing that full-time.
Yeah, basically full-time, although it was sort of a come in early in the morning, work late at night.
Was it basically sports writing?
Yeah, all sports writing. And in the process, after I quit the night job, I started to become a basketball referee, and I went back to refereeing. And I spent 38 years then as an official in football and basketball.
Football, too?
I sat down here not long ago and listed everything I'd done in officiating. And I actually came out with 22 sports that I'd worked in at some level between the local and the international level in 22 sports. And that's a lot when you think about where in the world did you come up with 22 sports?
And the rules
yeah.
22.
Sometimes you made them and you went, you weren't sure. But that was an interesting part of my life. And I still work in weightlifting and powerlifting as an official. Can't run anymore.
So you did some of that, I guess, while you were doing the sports.
Yeah. A lot of nights I'd go work a basketball game and come back. And I'll never forget one night we had a rough night at the basketball court. I came back and the kids would call in the box scores. And we had a staff there. We'd take the box scores. And I took this one box score. And we always said, who were the officials? Because we always listed the officials. And this gal who was a girl student reporter from this high school, she said, the officials were two fat dummies. That was me.
One.
So.
Okay. So, to continue, you were doing this for a few years.
I did that until 1968. And at that, I had started as a bird dog in 1956 when I came back from pro ball. I had started as a bird dog for the Milwaukee Braves because they would see me, the scouts would see me behind home plate, and they would say, you're always around here. You're always behind the plate. You're always at these good games. Yeah. So the guy from the Braves put me on at the end.
There was no conflict of interest.
No, because I was back after I finished that 56 season. I wasn't going back to pro ball at that point. So between starting with the 57 through the 61 seasons, I was a bird dog for the Braves. I get $50 a year.
At
Christmas time, a year.
No matter how many guys you sign.
That's right, a year at Christmas time. And then in 62, I went back to umpire school and signed a contract. Well, I had to leave the Braves. That would have been a conflict. So I left the Braves. When I came back and became the recreation director, it would have been in the fall of 62, I got a call from a scout named Chet Montgomery from Kentucky who had just signed a contract with the Pittsburgh Pirates as a full-time scout in the Midwest. He was going to run some tryouts.
Had you known him previously?
No, I'd never heard of him. And he didn't know me from Joe Blow. What he did is he called Columbia, Missouri, is in the middle of the state, where the University of Missouri is located. It's right in the middle of the state. And he called and he said, I was just looking at the map. I don't know my way around out there, but I have Missouri and Iowa and Kansas and Colorado. And he said, I think Columbia looks like a good place to have a tryout. This was like in November. November 62, and I would like to have, I'd like to, maybe next June or July, I'd like to come in there with a try. We can set dates later, but would that be possible? And I said, it could be possible, but we're going to have to work out an arrangement.
A financial arrangement?
No, not necessarily a financial arrangement. I just said an arrangement. And he said, what is that? And I said, you give me a job as a bird dog? He said, well, I can't pay you anything. I said, I'm not asking you for pay. And I explained to him that I'd been a bird dog for Milwaukee for those years, and I wanted to get back into it because I enjoyed that. I enjoyed sitting with the scout and talking about players and breaking them down.
When you were with Milwaukee, did you have anybody were you able to recommend anybody? Did they sign anybody who had recommended?
They signed, the scout that I worked for was named Dick Keeley.
And I know the bird dog works for a particular scout.
Yeah, you worked for him. And I think probably my value to him was more negative than positive. In other words, he would come in, he'd ask me about a player, and he'd heard about him. And I'd say, well, I've had this guy several times, and he's an alibi artist. He takes strikes and tries to shift things and so forth. I wouldn't want him. I may have been more negative than positive, but
that's part of the game.
Yeah, sure. But I recommended two or three guys. Dick didn't sign many people. And I recommended two or three guys that eventually got signed. And he appreciated it. He was very disappointed when I left to go back to pro ball. When I came back, he'd been fired. So
now you're with Pittsburgh.
Now I'm with Pittsburgh. So I made an agreement with Montgomery. And he came in. Well, he didn't make it then. He came in with his wife. They drove through, and they were talking to people and learning his territory. And he said when he got home, his wife said, you better hire that guy in Columbia, Missouri, because he seems to know more about the Midwest than everyone else you've talked to put together. So I signed a recommending contract with him, and I worked through 63, 64, and probably 65 as a recommending. And did recommend some players that got signed there, including one named Isaiah Fireball Jackson, who we signed out of the Kansas State Penitentiary. I got him out, assigned to me. He was actually 24, but we called him 20 because we figured that he'd been in prison since he was 17. He hadn't aged that much yet. He didn't have any bad habits. Couldn't get any booze or cigarettes, so he was 7. He was 20. And if we'd had radar guns, he would have thrown over 100 miles an hour. He was a legend in semi-pro ball in Missouri and Kansas. And they wouldn't let the scouts in to see him. So I scheduled a weightlifting meet with a bunch of the kids that I was coaching in weightlifting. And we went in, and I said, when Fireball pitched? The recreation director said, I figured there was some reason you were up here. So he let me see him. And then he was eligible for parole, and I was able to work a bi-state parole with him, get him out. And he went out to the California State League, and I think the record will show, if I remember right, that he led the league in wins and losses, in innings pitched, in walks, and in strikeouts. He worked every third day, primarily 9 innings a day. And like I say, he probably would have thrown 100 plus. And he also led the league in holdups. And he left the ball club and came back home over Labor Day. And I loaned him $20 to get him through. He had jumped the club. The season wasn't over. He jumped the club and had enough money to get back home on the bus. I loaned him $20, and he used that $20 to buy a revolver and rob 3 cabins in Kansas City. And he's still in the slammer. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I, he's a pretty good artist. We take care of his artwork. So we've had a 40-year relationship with him. Still remain very close friends.
Couldn't get that out of the system.
Yeah. So anyway, in 66 probably, I think it was, I spent 2 years then, at least 2 years, as a part-time guy.
That's your advancing up. They started a bird dog and then
right.
Moved to part-time.
Yeah, I'm part-time. And I'm getting $500 a year. Man, that's pretty good cash. Well, I wasn't getting anything with Pittsburgh. That was back with Boston. I was Milwaukee. So I'm getting $500 a month. And then at the end of the 67 season, Bob Housen is over at Cincinnati, and he hires basically the whole front office staff of the Pittsburgh Pirates, plus a bunch of their scouts. He had to do it very delicately then.
Had he been with the Pirates previously?
No, Housen had not, but he came in there, but he knew these people, and he wanted them. A bunch of them had been with, some of them had been with St. Louis and so forth. He knew who he wanted. And as he said downstairs a while ago, I wanted to build my own program. And he went after these people. Rex Bowen was one, and Joe Bowen, his brother, and they took Chet Montgomery, my guru, my leader. And when they did that, that left the Midwest open for Pittsburgh. So I took that job. And that was my first full-time baseball job.
Do you remember about how much that paid?
Yes, I do. It paid $8,000 a year.
Step up, that's a big step. From what you were getting before.
I was making about $6,500 as a recreation director.
Oh, I see. No, I was thinking of the scouting.
Oh, yeah. It was, how many times?
But I guess
16 times what I was making.
You had to give up the recreation.
I stayed on at the newspaper. And of course, those days you were around home from the 1st of October to the 1st of March. You didn't go anywhere you were in. So I refereed and officiated and worked for the newspaper full time during that period of time. And at the end of the year, the fellow who had been the scouting director at Pittsburgh got fired, and he had promised me a raise, and it didn't happen. And Seattle came into being.
Seattle Pilots
came into being.
This would have been 1970.
This would have been 69. That was their only year of existence, was 69. And a good friend of mine who had been a sports writer at home, named Art Parrick, he worked for one paper, I worked for the other, and we'd been friendly rivals. Both of us riding the same car, and both of us turned in mileage and me money to our respective papers. But anyway, he had gone into pro baseball and the front office end, and he had been Finley's last farm director in Kansas City and his first farm director in Oakland. And as everyone else did with Finley, he eventually got fired.
Right.
And then he became the farm director with the Seattle Pilots. And I called him to get a friend of mine in Wichita, a job as a scout. He said, I'll think about it. And he called me back a couple of days later and he said, when's your contract up? I said, it doesn't make any difference. I said, yes, it does, because we're going to hire you, not your friend. So he said, we'll give you a 3-year contract, $9,500 a year. Well, that's $1,500 a year more than I'm making over here. That's about a 15-20% raise. That's fine. So they got me, I didn't renew with Pittsburgh, because in those days that was a problem, because you didn't go to another club unless they fired you. You didn't just say, I'm not going to sign with you and I'm going to sign with somebody else. That was a no-no. But Seattle was new and Perrick was an outlaw, so there wasn't any problem. So I went to Seattle. And of course, they went bankrupt after 1 year and they were sold over to Milwaukee. And Bobby Maddox became the scouting director over at Milwaukee, and he didn't care for me. and I still had another year on a contract at Milwaukee. And now, old friend...
In other words, they honored that contract.
They had to honor it, yeah. I worked at Milwaukee for a year. And then, at the end of my second year with that organization, first year with Milwaukee, my old friends came into play here. Chet Montgomery and the people that now had been for the last 2-3 years at Cincinnati called and said, is your contract? I said, no, not. Would you care if we called Milwaukee and asked for permission to talk to you? And I said, they'll pay for the call, I'm sure. and we did, and then I went from Milwaukee at the end of the 1970 season. I was there in Cincinnati for the 1970 World Series. And I stayed there then until through the 1988 season with Cincinnati.
Now, up to this time in your scouting career, did you have like any kind of mentor or help or anybody who you sort of picked it up when you were younger?
Well, as I said today in the meeting in the scouts panel we had downstairs, there were basically three people that I had tremendous respect for in baseball. The first one was Chet Montgomery. And he and I forged a relationship that went far beyond baseball. It was a family-oriented, friendly relationship. He was and still is. He's working as an advisor with Atlanta right now. We developed a very, very strong relationship. He was totally influenced by Rex Bolt, who, of course, had been the number one disciple of Branch Rickey, and who now was working for Bob Housen. And Montgomery brought me into the game with Pittsburgh, and he made sure that eventually I got over to Cincinnati. We talk all the time today. It's been a relationship that's just been, it's lifelong and far beyond the sport of baseball. And he was a guru in that he was a disciple of Rex Bowen, who was a disciple of Rickey, and today as a scout, I'm no different. If a guy can't run and throw, I walk away from him. It's just there. And in today's pumped up power age, I'm a sort of a dinosaur. But I notice that San Diego keeps wanting the players I bring in to them because they can run and throw. So, and the other person was, of course, Robert Housen. And he was that absolute perfect general manager. And he had nothing but great feeling for the people that worked with him. And, of course, then after I left there, I ran into a guy who had to be the best, the most feeling scouting director in the history of the game, was Paul Snyder. And I guess as I've gone along through the last 15 years or so, I find that I've become sort of a role model to a lot of other young scouts along the way. I've got probably a dozen guys that are working in baseball, some of them as far as high as general managers that I have brought into the game as bird dogs and part-timers and full-timers and scouting directors and everything else now. So this thread that started with Montgomery has gone through not only me, but through Larry Doty, who's been in and out of the hierarchy of baseball as a scouting director, was a Pittsburgh GM for a while, so forth. Montgomery was a huge force to the two of us.
Paul Snyder, he's with the Braves now.
He's still with the Braves. He's been with the Braves since he signed in 1957 as a first baseman.
Okay, so after Cincinnati, how did you get? Did you go directly to San Diego?
Paul hired me. No, I went to Atlanta. Marge has decided that it was time that several of us move on at Cincinnati. And we
she
moved on.
She's a tough person to work for, I guess.
Yes. She had more faith in her dog than she did in the humans that worked for her.
Did you have any direct dealings with her?
Oh, yes. She made a mistake. She said, "My door is always open. I'm always willing to listen." Well, that was only half right. Her door was always open, but she wasn't willing to listen. And I unloaded on her pretty good. And she wanted to fire everybody. But we had guaranteed 3-year contracts. She couldn't do it. So when our contracts were up, we knew where we were all going. Out. So she let us all go, and I knew we were going to go, and I'd already made an arrangement with Paul Snyder. I talked to several clubs, and
what was this arrangement. Around 1990?
This has been at the end of the 88 season. And then I went to work full time.
Did you still have pretty much the same territory?
Yeah, I had anywhere from 6 to 10 states in the upper Midwest. Everything from and varying from Arkansas to Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Canada, and even as far over as one time Eastern Tennessee and Kentucky and West Virginia, even at one time. So, through those years, through the 25 plus years I worked in the United States, I worked probably in, I guess 10 or 11 different states. Got to know them all pretty good. And then at Atlanta, Paul got moved sideways by Sherholz when he came in. A guy I trained named Chuck Lamar became the scouting and farm director over there. All of a sudden, one of my trainees is now my boss. I'm not too sure I did a very good job here. So, of course, Chuck now is...
You trained him too well.
Yeah, he's now is the general manager at Tampa. And I was having trouble with my knees and hips. The joints were going bad, and I was having trouble running tryouts and fun going and so forth. And I told Lamar, "I can't continue on the field down here. I'm dying down here on this field, trying to do things the joints won't allow me to do." And I said, "Let me out of this contract. I want to go someplace else." So they decided at that point to start an international program in Atlanta. So we talked, and they decided to make me the international director.
Now, how would this differ from what you were doing previously? I know you were going to do traveling, but how would your duties, how would they differ?
Well, I no longer would have a territory in the United States. My territory would be the rest of the world, except for Puerto Rico.
Well, that's going to make it harder for you, isn't it?
Yeah, but I wasn't going to do tryouts. That was understood. I wasn't going to do tryouts. So in the 12 years that I've been doing international work, I average about 45 tryouts a year. You figure that one out.
That's almost one a week.
That's right. There are times when I do 3 a day. But what I don't do anymore is fungal. And so I've become like the great Buddha sitting up with my clipboard.
Now, do you do this by yourself? Do you have an assistant? Or, when you go to these international
trials? Yeah, well, that's what we... When we started this international program, it was a hit and miss proposition. I didn't know where I was going. I know what countries they play baseball in. Braves only had people involved in the Dominican and to a small degree in Venezuela. The rest of the world was not, they had nothing. And what I would do is I'd look down at place like Panama, and there's a bunch of players coming out of Panama. San Gillian.
Rod Carew.
Yeah, Rod Carew. Yeah, and a lot of people. So I'd just call up the Federation, and they'd answer, and I'd say, "Did anybody speak English?" They didn't. I'd say, "Oh, gracias." There you go.
Yeah,
there we go. Right. So over the next 3 years, I put together a staff. It took about 3 years to really staff Atlanta through hit and miss and trial and error. But you had to find a good baseball person who was bilingual. And eventually, in all these countries, I would find it. We had recommending scouts, part-timers or full-timers, in Atlanta in about 60 countries. And I personally had been to 50 of them. And you ask about a tryout, all I would do is show up. And I expected these people would have the best players available, the ones they wanted me to see. And I still worked on the field, but I didn't fumble. I'd always go down and do the 60 yards and do the pitches and stopwatches. And sometimes I'd sit in behind the screen down on the field even and grade pitchers and so forth. And the physical stress was gone. I didn't have to fumble 1,000 times a day and so forth. So that worked. That worked.
Was the Braves the first team to do this in the National League?
No. By the time the Braves got into it, there were at least a half dozen clubs that were ahead of the Braves. I liked to feel when I left that I had taken the Braves to the top three. And I don't think anybody really questioned that, because we were one of the first clubs to put one individual in charge of the world out there. I had Latin America, I had Australia, Europe, you name it. Canada was all mine. And other clubs like L.A. would have a Latin American guy, a Mexican guy, somebody who would be covering the rest of the world. And they would wind up sometimes with some of the clubs that have four different international guys. But Atlanta was one of the few that had one person who handled it all, and it worked better that way. So I stayed there until we had an agreement to disagree at the end of the 1999 season.
So you were there about 10 years?
I was there 11 years, 11 seasons. And then I came over to San Diego. And they had even less to start with.
San Diego knew about you? Or?
When I got fired, they knew about me. And then I had a fella named Billy Brick, B-R-Y-K, who I had put on as a recommending scout about 1973 or 4 for Cincinnati and Chicago. I had Chicago for about 20 years. And he was a young ex-player, now coaching at a junior college. And I put him on as a recommending scout. And then helped him get into pro ball as a manager and so forth, and then later on as a scout in the business. And he had been the special assistant to Cam Bonifay at Pittsburgh. And at the end of the 99 season, San Diego hired him. Bill and Kevin Tyers were good friends. And they hired him, and Brick had told me, don't be too quick to sign with anybody. That's tampering, but we're not going to worry about that. Don't be too quick to sign with anybody, because there may be a place out here in San Diego. We're going to change things in San Diego. And he said, right now, I'm going there. So when I got fired, it made it easy. I got fired in August. Got fired day after my birthday in August. And they... So it was easy to make the change. And really, I was 67 at the time, and nobody wants a 67-year-old. I didn't get many offers. So they weren't in it. But San Diego never did understand my age. No one thought about it. So that was bad. That was the only offer, really, that I had. So that's where I've been since.
Now, how many miles a year would you say you travel?
Excuse me. When I was traveling the Midwest, I averaged about 55,000 miles a year driving, which is more than a lot of people did, but I always had a fairly good sized territory.
Your average is around 12 or 15,000.
Well, even for a scout, that's scouts usually run 30 to 35, something like that. I'd almost double that.
We had a big territory.
Had a big territory. And I chose to drive rather than fly. In fact, tough to fly in the Midwest because you go someplace, you're going to go to Superior, Nebraska, where the nearest airport's almost back home, so you might as well not bother to fly. And since I started in the international world, I really never have kept track. I do know that I still drive 25,000 to 30,000 miles a year through Canada and doing things for people in the United States, going to spring training and all these things. I still run up pretty good mileage in the car. And somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 a year in the air.
Freaking fire mouth.
Yeah, I've got a few. My kids don't take from me. They're always, Dad, you know, we want to go to Holland or someplace.
How many kids you have?
Five.
Who would you say are the top five baseball people you signed over the years?
Top five that I've signed. Well, Andrew Jones. He was probably the hardest throwing pitcher I ever signed was Bruce Bereni. Okay, two more. Gosh, without looking at a list of who I signed, Bruce Chen, who's in the big leagues now, he's been with about five different clubs now. He's always the guy they want in a trade, and then no one ever keeps him. He's out of Panama. He's a pretty good pitcher. I've had 14 guys, I guess, something like that, play in the big leagues. Four. That's a bad question. I can't remember.
It's okay.
I can't remember.
Okay, right. Okay. So you mentioned what you basically start with in looking at a prospect is if he can run and he can throw.
Right.
You can take it from there.
Those are God-given tools. You can improve them, but you can't put them in a person. You either have the genetic makeup to run and throw, or you don't have it. The genetics took care of that. Mom and Dad took care of that, or Grandma and Grandpa took care of that for you. They're then there. You can improve them. And even if you're a bad runner and thrower, you can improve what you got, but you'll never be a prospect. And then if that guy can run and throw, and he's a good athlete, he's probably going to be a fine defensive player someplace on that diamond. And then if he hits, he's worth good money. And if he hits consistently with power, then you pay a lot of money for him. But to me, a prospect must be able to win the game without the bat. He has to be able to do something without the bat. Either his running speed, his arm strength, his defensive ability. Take a Galarraga, for instance. You think of him as a great home run hitter or a good home run hitter. But he's also the best first baseman in the league. He makes infielders better by playing first base. He makes poor infielders into decent infielders because he can pick up everything that comes over. So Galarraga, to me, is a much more important player than a Mark McGwire, who has no tools once he lays the bat down. And so a fella has to be able to win the game without the bat. And if he can't, go back to the Ricky theory, he can't play. Speed never goes in a slump.
Now, when you have a prospect, somebody you want to sign, first, are you able to sign him yourself or you have to get an okay from the front office?
Right now, in the position I'm in San Diego, I don't have to have any permission to sign anybody. And when I go to Latin America, I go to Australia, all I do is just simply call up and say, hey, we signed this guy and he's going to report whatever. I have a signing bonus cap. And that cap, once I reach that cap, I couldn't sign Babe Ruth after that. I've used that money.
That's a cap for a particular player.
No, that's a cap for signing bonuses. Total for the year. At the beginning of the year, at the beginning of the year, I'm handed two budgets. One of them is an operating budget. And I've got, we've got a staff of 22 part-time or full-time scouts
that are under you.
That are under me. And I have to regulate their expenses so that they each of them has a budget limit, and I monitor that so that at the end of the year, the bottom line is we want to have spent less money slightly than the budget that we were handed. I also have a second budget, and it's called the bonus cap. So I'm allowed X number of dollars to spend on bonuses in a given year.
And this can vary depending on the player.
I don't care. They don't care whether I spend the all of it on one player or spend it all on 100 players. And last year we signed 38 players.
And you have money left over?
And I actually had about $75,000 left over at the end. So that's where we... San Diego doesn't have any idea who's out there. That's my staff. I deal primarily with Ted Simmons, who's the director of baseball operations, and with Kevin Towers, who's the general manager.
Do you deal with any other scouts? I mean, other than the ones that are under you?
No. That's domestic scouting is a separate department, and we have international. And one of the two or three organizations in baseball that has a total separation. Most of the places, when I was in Atlanta, it was all a part of scouting, domestic and international were all under one head. Over here, not so. And I think it really works better that way because I have X number of dollars. I go out and see a player. I don't have to call somebody and say, can I have $50,000? All I got to do is look down at my running budget. If I don't have $50,000 left, can't sign him. So.
Now, the players you look at, and you say you're interested in a particular player, want to sign him, are they usually pretty receptive to the amount of the bonus that you offer? Is this a problem?
Yeah, it's always a problem. Money rears its ugly head on almost everybody. And you almost get to the point of insulting each other. But Paul Snyder told me something when I went to work for Atlanta. If you like the guy, sign him. If it's too much, don't worry about it. In other words, if he wants $125,000 and you only want to give him $100,000, hey, it was a mistake at $100,000, so might as well be a mistake at $125,000. Let's sign him and get him out of here. And I've kind of followed that same policy. At San Diego, I know how much money I've got. And I know how much, if the player costs too much money and it's going to jeopardize signing another player or two for less down the road, I probably will just simply walk away from that player. I'll let somebody else sign him at the price he wants, even though I don't think it's too high. So you have to negotiate in your mind whether you want to go to the limit on that guy. They've all got a price. We've got a minimum or a maximum. And sometimes they just don't match up.
Now, in your work, I guess you run across competing scouts.
Oh, yes.
That can be tricky and touchy and... in other words, I guess you've got to keep that in mind, too.
Yeah, you in the international world where there is no draft, if you see a player today, if you have a player in a workout today, or you see a guy in a ball game today, and you like him, and he's old enough, you go home with him. That's it. We're gonna sign now. And there may be two or three or four other scouts waiting to do the same thing in the ballpark, in the parking lot right alongside you. You hope that your scout in that country has a better relationship with that family than the other people have.
So you have to make some quick decisions.
So you see a kid, many spend the time in the last 2 years with San Diego, where I don't have to call and get permission on anything. We have a kid in the workout. Never see him in a ball game. We just simply work him out. He shows the tools he's got to play down the road. And he's 16, 17 years old, and you say, all right, this guy's going to play. And you think, now, how much am I going to give him? And you make your decision, you go home with him. And if you get him out of the ballpark and to his house before the other scouts do, you got a chance to sign him. But if you either sign him or you know somebody else is going to. When you leave that house, you better have a contract or you're not going to get it. Somebody else is going to come in and top it. Anything, of course, with the draft, you still compete, but it's not on a face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball situation.
Say you sign 50 guys. What is a good percent that you would hope to? I mean, I know it's hit and miss, but is there something special?
We used to follow the rule of thumb in the United States, where you signed a lot of filler players and so forth. If one out of 20 that you thought was a prospect, you signed him as a prospect, if one out of 20 became a full-time major leaguer, you had a good year. That's the batting average of 0.050.
5%.
And you would never sign a player who hit 050. That's the scout's average. Internationally, it's a little better than that, because what we're doing is we're signing players that we think are going to play in the big leagues more than just fringe guys.
What are some of the countries you've been in your travels? Some that maybe the average person wouldn't think.
How about San Marino? That's a city state. That's a city state in
Spain or something?
No, it's in Italy, near not far from Rome, near Rimini. In fact, Rimini's here, and just down the road a few miles is San Marino, and I've been. They have a ballpark there, right on the mountainside. I've been in there, and I've been to New Zealand, and of course Australia, Guam.
I like the Philippines.
I haven't been there, but I just talked to a guy yesterday who was my bird dog in the Philippines.
Well, there's certainly American influence in
there. Baseball there is not very good, and the American influence is gone there now. Just like it is in Panama. But I've been to Chile and run tryouts, Argentina. I was just in Ecuador last month. And Peru.
Greece?
Only for weightlifting.
You know, there's a Sabre player, a Sabre member on the West Coast. I forgot his name, but he has dual citizenship. He's going to be playing for the Greek baseball team in the 204 Olympics.
Greece qualifies as being the host. They're going to be hitting meatballs over there.
In your work, do you have any dealings with agents?
With agents?
Agents.
Yes. In fact, I have a lot of dealings with agents. When I was in the United States, I refused to talk to an agent. I just absolutely hated them, because I thought they were destroying the game, which basically I think they are. In Latin America in particular, I've become pretty friendly with the agents, and they realize that I want to sign Latin players. So we can talk pretty good. Yesterday I missed the committee meeting here in this Sabre meeting because I was on the phone with an agent. And maybe I've mellowed as the years go by, but I also find that some of these agents are very, very honest people. Some aren't. And I've told two or three of them, get out of my life and stay out of it. Don't ever call me again. And others, I'll actually call the agent and start a negotiation with them.
Now, what kind of changes have there been in scouting because of the draft?
Well, prior to 1965, a scout ran his own world, basically. He saw a player just like I do internationally. I see a player, I try to sign him if he's eligible. Prior to 1965, he did the same thing in the United States. He tried to sign the player. The club with the most money got the most players. And that's the reason behind the draft. The draft is supposed to put everybody on an even playing field. Consequently, scouts became record keepers. And judgments probably meant less, because if you had a high draft, a kid that's going to be a high draft, you'd have 5, 6, 7 opinions on this guy. And the territorial scout, for all purposes, becomes nothing more than a bird dog to lead in the cross-checkers and the scouting directors and the general managers to see that player. And that's unfortunate, because it really, when I was a territorial scout, I'd go 2-3 years sometimes without getting the draft. But my records would be just fine. I had everybody in the proper draft order, and the scouting director look at that and say, oh, he's doing a good job. I got no players playing. And that's the way it's always going to be. And now they want to put in a worldwide draft. But I've told myself the day they put in a worldwide draft, the day I quit. Because I don't want to go back to that again, or working year-round and hope I get somebody on draft day. Most of the scouts today have never worked any other way than that. And it's an easy way of life for them. You go do your work, you see all the players in your 4 or 5 states, and you list them in the order you like them, and the high ones, the cross-checkers come in to see, and you wait for draft day, and you think, geez, I hope I get somebody. And if you get somebody high, they say, oh, what a great scout he is. Hey, you want a greater scout for that than anything else, because you can't be born in your territory. You didn't have anything to do with that.
Now, I guess you're probably on a salary, I would imagine.
Yeah.
You get any kind of bonuses or commissions if guys make it or anything like that?
I'm the same as the guy carrying a lunch bucket to the steel mill.
How often do you keep in touch with your boss? So there are two of them. You report to. Do you do it weekly or monthly, or just when something comes up?
It's governed by necessity. Every time I go someplace, I file a report back. I've been to Australia. I'll update you on the Australian Pacific area here. And I might do that. I go to Australia 3 times a year. Boss will get 3 written reports. Written reports. I may never call unless I need to.
Now, when you're looking over a prospect, I know you've got this gut instinct, but do you have like a form or something to fill out that helps you?
Oh, yeah. Every ball club has its own forms and various things, running speed, arm strength, arm accuracy.
It's height and weight.
Yeah, height, weight. They have all these details. and the grading system. Each club has its own grading system. And you put all these grades in and so forth, and usually a physical description and what have you. You do that. But here, once again, where I work in the international world, we seldom write reports. Don't need to. Saw the guy play, we go find him.
You gotta act quickly.
Yeah.
With other scouts, do you ever actually talk to them about other players you look at?
We sit around.
But you might not give honest opinions.
Yeah, a lot of times you do. What you do if you like them. If you got a guy out in the bull rushes someplace, you don't tell anybody about it. But when you're talking about a first round draft, or anyone in the first 10 rounds probably in the draft, there's not a lot of secrets there. And sometimes you actually share a little information about guys injury, if it's known he's got an injury, I say, hey, you better check the guy's knee or something. You know, you don't let your buddy get hung up for something that everyone else knows. If nine scouts know that thing and he doesn't, help him out a little bit.
When you were a territorial scout, did you ever have any disagreements with the front office about you felt somebody should be signed and they...
Every day. Mr. Housman is a good example of a general manager who would listen to the territorial scout. And as the cross-checker and the scouting director would say, oh, we don't think that guy's worth that much money. And if Housman talked to you and you felt he was worth that much money, he at least compromised. And that happens every day. No one agrees on money no matter where you are.
Are scouts thought of as, well, highly thought of by general managers and the owners?
Owners couldn't care less about scouts. They have no feeling for scouts. They're simply no different than corn fed to hogs. And general managers vary. The Robert Housmans of the world lived and died with the scouts. They were as much a part of the organization as the big league players. Other general managers couldn't care less. And I could name a few, I won't here, but some of them are atrocious in their relationship with personnel under them.
How many scouts does San Diego have?
This is kind of off the top of my head. We've got a couple of guys who work the big leagues. I think three, actually, who work the big leagues. And we've got about five who work all the rest of professional baseball, AAA down. And we've got about, I would guess somewhere between 15 and 20 would be my guess, on the domestic side that are full-time. And then we've got probably 8 or 10 part-time guys around. I have, in the international world, almost a staff that big. I've got 5 full-time people and about 17 part-time people.
Excluding the international, is San Diego, is it comparable with other clubs?
I think so. It's more or less, yeah.
What are some of the pluses and minuses of scouting life? I guess being away from home quite a bit is a minus.
I tell you what, when I first started, I'd been married 13 years when I first started full time. And yeah, you're still a young man. You're still eager to get home and visit with mama a little bit. And there'd be times when you'd head for home when you probably should have gone to a ball game. Those things are a problem, you know. It's better to take them home than not. So, as you stay out in the world, you it's easier to travel now. My wife and I have been married 47 years, and
she's a good woman.
Yeah, and as she said, the only thing I'm interested in coming home now is your paycheck. So. But yeah, it takes a woman and a family, not only the wife, but a family, that understands what your job is. And one of the good aspects of it is that I do a lot of bird watching and wildflower photography. And I've had a chance to build a bird list of, I don't know, probably 2,500 species around the world. I guess I've never counted them up. And I've got probably 10,000 slides of wildflowers that I've taken, and I never get a chance to get home and get them logged properly. Some of them I don't have any idea where they came from.
So you take a camera with you when you're traveling?
I do a lot.
There was a whole thing for scouts. Name five.
Larry something from the pre-World War One days, from the period between the wars, uh, gee whiz. Wish Egan, the two Yankee guys, Paul Critchell, Bill Essick, name is escaping, Steinbach Feller. Too bad. Old age is that name. I lost that name. And since then, you got guys, since the Second World War, you got guys like Hugh Alexander, Rex Bowen, Howie Haig. Back to that between the years deal is Joe Cambria, who brought the Cubans in. Just a huge amount of people.
What's your funniest experience as a scout? or a funny one?
Good land. I don't know. I'll have to think about that a little while.
What advice would you give for a young scout? Coming into the profession.
At this point, I tell him, don't do it. And there's several reasons for that. One, the profession, unless it gets representation, which is another word for unionization, I wouldn't suggest any young man who has a family, a young family, to get involved in scouting. There are no guarantees. There's no security whatsoever. I've been fired twice because of people who come into the front office and their only interest is to bring their friends in. People who are in a position that their friends would have to go. Look what happened in Montreal and Florida this year in the big league. Move wholesale movement. And if a guy decides he wants to get in this racket and he refuses to listen to common sense, I guess you tell him to learn Spanish. That's number one. Really, truly. And become totally computerized. Because that's the way it's going. But I've told a number of guys, don't do it. If you're an older guy, fine. But stay away from this game. And stay away from scouting, at least. I can almost say that about being a minor league coach. Stay away from it. The security is brutal where young people are concerned, young family men are concerned.
Who would you say is the best judge of talent you've run across, a non-scout?
The best judge of talent? Paul Snyder was a pretty good one. Howie Haig.